Tonight's programme is a tribute to the late P.J. McGrath, the philosopher who died in August of this year. When we spoke in 2004, his most recent book, The Objectivity of Morals, had just been published by Estragon Press. P.J. McGrath was one of Ireland's leading philosophers. He spent most of his working life at University College Cork, but he began his career in Maynooth, having studied in Louvain and Oxford. His main research interests were moral philosophy and the philosophy of religion. Among his publications were The Nature of Moral Judgment and The Justification of Religious Belief. Over 30 years ago, he came to national prominence when he was dismissed from Maynooth College for the publication of articles described as prejudicial to ecclesiastical authority. I asked him to remind us of what happened.
Well, I had published four articles, three of which were published in ecclesiastical journals with an imprimatur, but they were still denounced as being prejudicial to ecclesiastical authority, and I was dismissed. I lost my post in Maynooth as a result.
Were these the articles, was the one on Humana Vitae, which was
yes.
Was that one of them, subsequently published
yes.
in Believing in God in
that's right,
in
yes.
90s, yeah.
And yes, that's right.
What was the others? There was one on infallibility, was that?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, and that, what was the third one they took exception to?
There was an article in the Irish Times, which that one caused the most offence, I think. It was an analysis of the bishop's pastoral, which came out after Humana Vitae, and which supported the Humana Vitae line, as you might expect. I mean, it was naturally, it was simply repeating what Humana Vitae said. And,
yes.
And there were three articles which appeared one after the other on successive days in the Irish Times. One written by Donald Flanagan.
Yes.
One by Jerry Watson, and one by myself.
Now, who was the article in coming out in favour of it?
No, there wasn't any article.
Oh, I misunderstood.
No,
I thought
no.
somebody
no,
had
no,
come
the,
out.
No, no, these articles were critical of the bishop's pastor.
Sure, sure.
Because they seemed to go even further than the Vatican.
Yeah, they were to both, Watson was a classical scholar,
yes,
Donald
right.
Flanagan, theologian, you a philosopher. I would have thought that it was harder for church authority to censure a philosopher, which you were and are, than a theologian. Is that so?
Yes, I suppose that's true, yes.
It'd be
in theory, in
But in fact they did.
Fact they did, but the reason they did wasn't entirely the content of the article. It was because of the fact that I'd indicated that I wished to be laicized.
Uh-huh.
From the priesthood. So they didn't want to have a laicized former priest on the Maynooth staff. So they decided that I'd have to be got rid of.
So that was the reason more than anything you'd written, is that right?
Yes, well, that's my interpretation.
That's your interpretation?
Yes, yeah.
Even though they wouldn't have been happy with what you had to say about Humana Vitae?
No, they wouldn't.
About
no,
papal
no.
authority mm. Or papal infallibility or whatever. By the way, on that period, what looking back on it now, what how valuable was it to you, your years in Maynooth?
Well, I suppose I was growing up in a certain sense, so there were, those years were valuable in that sense. And they were valuable also in the sense that I got a certain amount of work done, articles written and so forth.
But in terms of the climate itself?
The climate itself. Mm-hmm. Well, the climate itself was certainly heavily influenced by Humana Vitae.
Yes.
See, in the period leading up to the Vatican Council and in the period shortly after it, there was a great feeling of change. There was a marvellous feeling of release by people in the church who were following what was going on and so on. And then suddenly Humana Vitae was issued, and that changed the atmosphere completely.
Mm. Doesn't it say a lot for the old order, for the pre-conciliar church, that it had people at that time, particularly theologians, who were very open to the new.
That's true.
In the 60s. Well, why do you think that was?
I think it was partly because of the intolerable character of the old. We were all very conscious of the fact that the old order was simply out of date and couldn't continue. And, for example, even as students, the regime in Maynooth was incredibly strict. And seeing that going out the door, out the window, was an enormous release. So that... I think we were very, very favourably disposed towards the changes brought about by Vatican II.
And Humana Vitae was essentially being buttressed by authority at a certain point,
that's
wasn't
right.
it?
Yes, this
was it.
Yeah,
so
yes,
reason, they,
yes.
they weren't really producing arguments, and it was a domain where arguments should have been produced.
Exactly, yes. Mm. But there was one extraordinary phenomenon which I observed at the time, and that was that the generation which followed our generation, I'm using our generation in the Maynooth sense, seven years...
Sure.
They tended to become rather conservative, again, as if they were afraid of the changes that had taken place and were taking place in the church. And also perhaps because they hadn't lived under the Ancien regime as well, so maybe they weren't as fully aware of it as we were.
When did your interest in philosophy begin?
I suppose it began when I studied philosophy for my BA in Maynooth. We did philosophy as an introductory subject in First Arts and also logic. And I became fascinated with the subject, even at that stage. And I decided to do it for my degree. And then I did an MA and got a travelling studentship, which meant I had 3 years abroad to study.
Louvain was the traditional graduate school for clerical philosophy students. What kind of environment was Louvain?
It was rather too similar to Maynooth,
was it really?
For my liking. Yeah. The philosophy was it wasn't very open to changes and so on. And as far as it was open to continental philosophy rather than to Anglo-Saxon or Anglophone philosophy, which was my particular interest. So I didn't particularly enjoy my years in Louvain. But I spent a year in Oxford in between the 2 years I spent in Louvain, and I felt Oxford much more congenial than Louvain had been.
And Oxford, who were the dominant figures at Oxford when you were there?
John Austin had just died. He died in 1960, and I think, and I went to Oxford in 62. Ryle was still there, and he was probably the dominant influence at the time. And A.J. Eyre had just returned to Oxford from London University. But he didn't seem to me to be as influential as some of the others. Dummett was there as well, of course. And he was quite influential because he attended a lot of student gatherings. He was a clubbable sort of character. But he was, of course, influential, philosophically speaking, as well.
Well-known Roman Catholic.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes. And yeah. Anscombe was teaching there, Elizabeth Anscombe.
And Peter Geach, no.
Peter Geach was teaching in Leeds, I think, he was regularly in Oxford and took part in discussions and so forth.
But what did it do for you? I mean, I get the impression this turned you in a particular direction.
No, I wouldn't think so. I think I was already turned, if you know what I mean. That I'd been studying English-speaking philosophy before I went to Oxford.
Oh, had you? I had.
And my MA thesis was on that sort of philosophy.
So you were simply, this was a kind of a confirmation,
an endorsement of
a kind of line you'd taken.
Yes.
And how would you describe its characteristic approach, the analytic, the Oxford analytic so-called approach, from, say, the Continental? What were its distinguishing features?
Well, I suppose the word analytic brings out one feature. They tend to break down problems into little pieces and so on and attack it from that point of view, rather than taking a big sweeping approach to a problem. You know, they try to analyse it bit by bit. And it's also that particular approach, the analytic approach, is much more dependent on argument. Argument is extremely important in that area of philosophy, much more so than on the Continent, for example. And there's a great deal of time spent analysing arguments.
So are you suggesting the continent is more a matter of assertion?
I would be inclined to say that, they're not as conscious of argumentation as they are in the Anglo-Saxon school. But the Anglo-Saxon school, I mean the English-speaking word.
Yeah. In other words, you in the kind of analytic tradition, there's not a whole lot you'd get away with. People are saying, what do you mean by that? And
exactly.
They're pushing you back all the time.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
So language is foregrounded in that tradition, isn't it?
It is, yes. I mean, it's sometimes these people are described as linguistic philosophers, but that wouldn't be quite accurate. I mean, it is true that language is very important for them, but their approach to philosophy goes beyond language. And in many ways, I would think analytic philosophy is closer to the sort of philosophy you find, say, in St. Thomas Aquinas than continental philosophy is.
Yeah.
St. Thomas Aquinas' approach to philosophy is very like that. He's very much an empiricist, and he needs argument.
Would that be true of medieval philosophy in general?
I think it would, I think it would,
And one thing that strikes me, I mean, here you were with this formation in Maynooth, in Louvain, Oxford. Then you spent a lifetime teaching. What did you learn from your students in all these years?
Well, I found students very useful in the sense that they forced me to examine my own assumptions. You know, they will ask very basic questions and sometimes spring a trap on you. And they make you think in a way you wouldn't do if you're working on your own. So that they're a great intellectual stimulus, particularly good students, of course, postgraduates and so on. So that they force you to be much more careful about what you're saying, what you're asserting, and so on.
What's your idea of your approach to the master-disciple relationship in philosophy? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I am very suspicious of it. Naturally, anyone beginning philosophy is bound to have a sort of master-disciple relationship with somebody whom he admires. But once you grow up, philosophically speaking, I think any sort of discipleship relation is out of place, because philosophy by definition, or a philosopher by definition, is someone who thinks for himself, not someone who obtains his opinions from somebody else.
And yet it's often said that the way a philosopher develops, one of the best ways, is by engaging totally with the mind of another thinker.
Yes.
A kind of apprenticeship, if you like, almost.
Yes.
But I suppose that needs...
probably true, but it should lead on to the next phase.
Yes,
where you assert your independence, just as in a human being growing up eventually has to assert his or her independence.
And it's an area of fashion, philosophy, like anything else. I mean, what have you noticed in your opinion?
Fashion, I think, is quite important in philosophy, but it shouldn't be. You know, in the sense that philosophers are often heavily influenced by what's fashionable. But that seems to me to be a mistake, and it never does philosophy any good, because it means that they are being influenced by something that's not quite rational.
When you say fashionable, like fashionable thinkers or a fashionable set of problems or what?
Fashionable thinkers are fashionable theories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, at one stage, logical positivism became very fashionable in English-speaking philosophy. But it seems to me that it had very little merit, and it was being accepted for reasons which had very little to do with philosophical merit, really.
This is to do with theories of meaning and so on, isn't it?
Yes,
it took the view, explained to us about under what conditions propositions made sense.
Yes, that's right, yes. But it was used in a very negative way by practitioners of logical positivism. It was used, you know, to claim or to argue or to assert that the problems of metaphysics are only pseudo-problems, that they're not real problems at all, and that if you were clear about our use of words, these problems would disappear.
Yes.
And that seems to me a wholly unwarranted approach.
Very convenient way of dealing with metaphysics,
right,
I suppose.
Yes, yes.
We can do it. But that fashion didn't last that long, did it?
No, it didn't last very long. It began about the mid-30s, I think, and it probably lasted until the mid-50s. But some of its characteristics remained on, though, even after that period.
But the big fashions in recent times have come from Paris, haven't they? And indeed from Germany. I mean, Heidegger is one. Not many analytic philosophers engage with them.
No.
Why is that?
Well, they seem to speak different languages, I think. And they seem to approach philosophy in a very different way. Heidegger is almost, you could describe him as a sort of philosophical prophet or seer. And that's not the analytic approach at all. It's the analytic approach is, as I said, very argumentative and based on analysis rather than on sweeping assertions.
But the fact that it's a different language doesn't mean Heidegger, say, hasn't something valuable to say.
No, yeah. I'm sure he has something valuable to say, but it's sometimes very difficult to know what it is.
Well, on that point, I mean, you believe firmly in clear writing. I mean, obscurity is not for you.
No. Well, insofar as I can avoid it, it's not for me. If you're dealing with difficult problems, you're always liable to lapse into obscurity. But I think the thing is to avoid it as much as possible. Try and be as clear as possible in what you're writing.
I mean, the usual defence, as you say, of obscurity is that in the matter, if the matter in hand is so technical, of a very technical kind, it may require a certain kind of language.
Yes, but I would regard that as a slightly different point from the point about obscurity.
Uh-huh.
That involves the use of technical language, technical terms and so on. Whereas the sort of obscurity I was talking about was somebody who uses language in a very ambiguous way and doesn't take the trouble to make clear what exactly he means.
Or a very ornate way, often.
Yes.
I mean, the only time you encounter anything non-verbal, really, is in philosophical logic, isn't it? I mean, apart from that, there's no need for you to use anything but simple words.
In philosophy?
Yeah. I mean, philosophical logic is one area where you may have... the use of the non-verbal.
Yes, that's true. But the problem is that almost every subject, as it tends to get more and more sophisticated, tends to use jargon and tends to use technical language. It's an almost inevitable progression. Yes, yes. So that it's very difficult to avoid using that sort of language when you're writing philosophy. But that doesn't necessarily involve obscurity. As long as you explain your terminology, then you can avoid obscurity.
How is philosophy perceived by other disciplines in this country? I mean, I ask that in view of the fact that it seems to have a kind of adjudicating role. You know, we talk of philosophy of science, of religion, of law, of mathematics.
Well, that varies very much with the person you're speaking to, I should think. Some scientists are immensely interested in the philosophy of science, whereas others take no interest in it at all, or very little interest at any rate. And I'm sure the same is true of historians. Some historians would probably be interested in philosophy of history. Others wouldn't have any time for it at all. So it depends a bit on who you're speaking to.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, I mean, that's why I say in the country as a whole, I mean, you know, among your colleagues in that, and you've worked in a couple of universities here, the sense to which how seriously it's taken by the various other disciplines.
Well, I think that philosophy is taken very seriously by theologians, for example, because theology is to some extent dependent on philosophy. It gets many of its concepts from philosophy. And the whole question of the rationality of religious belief is something that theologians have to take account of. So in that sense, theologians probably take it more seriously almost than anybody else outside of philosophy itself.
In fact, at one time here, it was seen as a kind of philosophy, that is, a kind of handmaiden to theology, wasn't it?
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was because of the Thomist understanding of faith. You know, according to the Thomist understanding of faith, there's a thing called the preamble of faith, which is that you, in order to believe, you must first of all believe that God exists, that he is truthful, and that he has revealed certain things to mankind. And that's the preamble of faith. And that preamble can only be handled, obviously, philosophically, because theology presupposes it. So, of course, for that reason, philosophy was regarded as the handmaiden of theology.
There's a kind of element of circularity here, isn't there? I noticed in your article on faith and reason, in that book, Believing in God, that, you know, the idea you need to be a Christian believer before you can appreciate the reasons for Christian faith. It's hard to avoid an element of circularity in that, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's on one way of understanding faith.
Sure.
There is that circularity, certainly. And I suppose that's the more contemporary understanding of it. But the old Thomist conception of faith, I don't think there was any circularity involved, really. But the problem with the Thomist conception is that philosophy isn't really able to prove the preamble of faith. You know, it claimed it could, but...
It just asserts it. Among your students, did you find... How is philosophy of religion, did it tend to grab them?
Yes, I think so, yes. I've been told several times that it was a course that they liked best. So even though some of them mightn't have been religious believers at all, they did seem to be interested in the problems involved in the philosophy of religion. I suppose we all are, in a way, because we're all confronted with questions about the significance of human existence, the meaning of human life and so on. Is there anything after death? And from that point of view, everybody is interested in the philosophy of religion, I think.
And you found that, say, were they more interested in that than in moral philosophy, your students?
Oh, yes, I would think so, yes.
There's a related idea to the one we were talking about there, about the ranking of disciplines, and that is that I'm thinking of something championed by people like Bernard Williams, that philosophers working on, say, society need to be deeply knowledgeable about the work done by social theorists. In other words, that a philosopher working in different domains needs to know that domain pretty well before philosophizing about it.
Yes, yeah. I think that's certainly true.
Yeah.
I mean, the most obvious example of it would be philosophy of science. Because unless you know some science, you're just floundering. You have to have some sort of scientific background to do philosophy of science. And I suppose the same is true of philosophy of history and so forth. And I suppose the theory of knowledge, say epistemology, you'd have to know a fair amount about science and the development of science and so on to attack the problems of epistemology.
You wonder, does philosophy solve any problems at all, or is it mainly a matter of clarifying presuppositions?
Well, you know, Wittgenstein famously said that philosophy leaves everything as it is,
yes,
which seemed to indicate that he thought that he didn't really solve anything at all. But I'm not sure he really believed that.
You know, he also said, didn't he, that no problem is solved until all problems are solved. Yes.
Well, you see, that's a counsel of despair. You can't get started.
Yeah. But what's your view of that? I mean, that does it solve anything?
It does for me, certainly. You know, I've come to certain conclusions which I've reached through philosophy or through philosophical reasoning and so on. So from that point of view, I think it does solve certain things. But I wouldn't claim that I'm characteristic. I'm sure a lot of people might find philosophy very empty because it doesn't really get you anywhere.
You see, this, we're hovering on the whole question of method here. That, I mean, is there any common method in philosophical analysis? I mean, the kind you find in the physical sciences and to a lesser extent in the human sciences?
Well, I think that there are certain elements which are common to almost any sort of philosophy. And one would be the analysis of concepts, conceptual analysis.
Which would be the linguistic tradition or the analytic tradition.
But you also find it in Plato and in Aristotle and so on.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
very
obvious in Plato. He's constantly engaged in conceptual analysis. So that's pretty well common to nearly all philosophical
except
traditions.
Except the so-called continental tradition.
Well, even Heidegger would engage in that.
Yes.
And sometimes employs very doubtful etymology in order to make his points. But anyway, he does seem to engage in conceptual analysis at a certain level. And I think that's pretty common to all of them. But the big difficulty with philosophy arriving at conclusions is that you can't really falsify a philosophical theory, unlike a scientific theory. See, a scientific theory is falsifiable. You can always say.
In fact, forgive me. So, I mean, so, the view is, isn't it, since Karl Popper, that's what defines it as scientific, that whether it's falsifiable or not.
Yes.
Now, you've nothing comparable in philosophy. Can you say that's a falsifiable thesis?
Well, if you could show a philosophical theory to be self-contradictory, then you would have falsified it. But it's very, very difficult to do that, and it can only be done, obviously, in a very, very small number of cases. So essentially, there's no method of falsification in philosophy, and therefore no way of dividing good theories from bad theories in any kind of conclusive way.
You're talking about the primacy of language at the moment. If you look at in a kind of triune way, as the three forks being language, the human subject or mind, and the world and the other, that kind of that threefold setup. Mm. In recent times, I suppose, language, is it? You say that's where it's at, as they say.
Yes.
Is
well,
it?
I suppose you're driven back to language.
Yeah.
You start thinking about the world. You then began to say, well, how do we speak about the world? And the same is true of the human mind. So I suppose almost...
But forgive me, what's happening there isn't is that language is making the running. In other words, you analyse whatever you analyse first, you then force the other two to say, what kind of thing, what way must the world be in order to match the way we've analysed language? Isn't that what you're doing, in effect?
Yes. Although I would imagine that contemporary philosophy would be very chary of that approach.
Yes.
That certainly happened in the past.
Yeah.
That people constructed a model of the world on the basis of their model of language.
But isn't that an inevitable consequence of assigning primacy to language? Yeah?
Well, it depends on the sort of primacy you assign to it. I mean, you find it in the early Wittgenstein. His model of the world in the Tractatus is based on his model of language. Language is a mirror.
And then he abandoned that, yes.
But he abandoned that later, in his later philosophy.
What role do intuitive hunches play in philosophy? You know, I mean, a lot of the time you find, talking to professional philosophers, that there's a sharp division between, you know, what they would like the world to be, if you like, and what argument can sustain.
Yes. Well, I think... hunches or conjecture, guesses, if you wish, plays a huge role in both science and philosophy. And that it all begins with guesses, and then you test the guess to see if it'll come out right. In science, that's how it works. Yeah. Now, in philosophy, you haven't the same opportunity for testing, but you can test it in a different way. You can test it by seeing if you can construct reasonable arguments in support of this.
I mean, it strikes me there's nothing you can do about your starting point. If, say, for example, on the classic realist, anti-realist divide, that you, in your heart, believe there is something out there, regardless of anything I may think, then that's something you're stuck with. And I mean, if you're a professional philosopher, you're concerned with whether that can be sustained or not. But the initial take-off point is something is a function of your environment, heredity, chemistry, whatever. Yeah.
Yes, that's probably true, I suppose. Yeah. Human nature provides us with a picture of the world which we're to some extent we are stuck with. You know, whether we like it or not, we all believe that there are other people with minds more or less like our own. We believe that instinctively, and it would be impossible for us to abandon that belief, even though we may not be able to justify it.
But if you get access to certain kind of tools, the tools of the philosopher logician, then you'll have ways of dealing with it.
You will never succeed in proving it to be true. Mm. Well, the best you can do is to show that the arguments for showing it to be false don't work.
Yes,
as far as you can go. And that's why philosophy, I suppose, is somewhat unsatisfactory in certain areas.
P.J. McGrath, whom I spoke to in 2004, after the publication of his book The Objectivity of Morals, published by Estragon Press. Tonight's Off the Shelf is broadcast in memory of P.J. McGrath, who died in August of this year.